So I think you're now full of questions and issues that you want to raise. So the audience, yes, Lisa.
Yeah. Thank you. I'm Lisa Roman. I come from CEDA. I think Gun took some of the points that I had already, but I can add some extra. Thank you for your presentation. It's very interesting and exciting to see so much new findings in this field. Just one point. I had the similar point that Gun had on your presentation about drivers, motivations for fundraising or for donations, that really the interesting importance to a donor or to us as policymakers is really what drives interest and legitimacy for what we're doing. But then I was thinking again that another point or another importance of understanding decision making is, of course, on a higher level than us as bureaucrats, because we are so much governed by regulations and others' wishes and stipulations and instructions. Although one can argue, one can, of course, dig into decision making and when it really happens and what we decide on still, even though we claim that we have all this regulation that governs us. But I think to understand the political decision making for what we prioritize or what politicians prioritize in different times is very important. Global crises and refugee crises or whatever conflicts are very important for urgent measures, because that is what counts for a politician. And if you can sort of explain and do work on that in order to sort of clarify and somewhat reduce perhaps the unpredictability or the sort of showcases appearing in this area would be a good job, I think. Of course, a question for Elin is this point you made about the problems with rising maize prices that you mentioned, because that is very puzzling, if that would be a policy implication that we should try to avoid price rises or improved profitability in agriculture, because it also causes costs. So I'm wondering about the dynamics of that analysis, really, although I understand that the finding may very well be that it also increases costs for those who are consuming maize in one particular time. And then I'm not going to... I'd like to talk to you, Montserrat, afterwards, because I think that was very interesting about the and both of your work about the developments in the Mekong Delta and in Vietnam in particular. I'm wondering about Acemoglu, your interpretation about the divide between one Acemoglu Robinson way of claiming that development happens and what you're saying. But I think that history matters is very, very important point. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Lisa. Does anyone of you, or maybe we'll see if there are any more questions. Anders, well, you spent a lot of time in Cambodia, I know. So
yes. My name is Conn Anders Larsson. Yes, I was very interested. Everything was interesting, so many issues. But especially, of course, those concerning Cambodia and Vietnam, where I've been working. And this about NGO advocacy strategies, especially interesting. And I fully agree that, of course, this has to be take into consideration the informal, but even more the informal rules in each case. And I think I missed a bit the importance of the difference between Cambodia and Vietnam in this case. I think NGOs, I think Forum Syd is very well aware of this, have to work very different in these two countries. In Vietnam, I think you cannot really, you have to work with the government. That's the only option. There is no other way to do it. But in Cambodia, very few NGOs do that, and they work with local organizations and they're trying to work with local stakeholders. And then, of course, they come into the, they will meet this problem with the formal and informal, especially informal rules. Then I was a bit interested because you mentioned about the decentralization, which is the most important reform in Cambodia, and is the leading donor supporting this has been Sweden, SIDA, for a long time. So it's very interesting for us, of course. And it's certainly very complex. But I mean, it's more complex than it's only this is a reason for the resistance, maybe from local leaders in this case, because there are also, and you mentioned about these resources allocated to local levels. That is, it's mainly informal ways. So it doesn't have to do with the policy. And of course, there's very little we can, as a government donor, can do to that. But I think it's very important to see the role of NGOs, government donors, and of course the central and local authorities in this case. So I think there are a lot of questions to discuss. And about Vietnam was very interesting. Of course, this difference between South and North is very clear, and it's not only, of course, agriculture is very important, but not only that. I mean, that's been a difference long time before the war, during the war, and after the war still. And it has to do very much also with the other sectors, economy, and not least politics. I think that would also be a very interesting start for discussion.
Okay. Thank you very much. I'm looking at my watch here, and obviously, I think some of these comments from the audience and also from Gunn and Magnus, I think, have really underlined so the relevance of the work that you've done also for policymaking. I mean, there may not be sort of a clear line, but you bring up issues related to trying to understand, I mean, what's behind development, what's behind the things we see, what is behind the actions, and also donors' own actions. Mm-hmm. And I think, in a way, that is a terrific challenge. How much do you need to understand of sort of a local context in order not to do harm, but in order to support a beneficial development? So I think, I'm as stimulated and also a bit despondent, because I think, I mean, how can you really expect a donor agency to have all sufficient local and in-depth knowledge? And it's not just about understanding what's going on now, but it's actually knowing what happened since 1500s. But I think what you're saying is that in order to be a good donor, and in order to be as effective or as useful as possible, we need to know what we're doing, and we need to listen to local voices and to our counterparts. I mean, if a Swedish or an international NGO will come in with their fundraising strategies or ways of working and try to impose them in a local context where you have maybe similar formal rules but completely different or contradictory informal rules, you will make life very difficult for your counterpart. So at least in my mind, I mean, these are things that I think at least should keep some people awake at night here. I think we're almost out of time. Would you like to make some final comment? One of you? Then I'll just give you just a few minutes or 1 minute for a final, and then we'll... Hopefully, many of us go over and have a beer together at M5.
Thank you very much. I would just like to make a small give a small answer to Lisa's comments. And I think that my reading of the Mace paper, so to say, is not that you should try to influence the prices so they don't increase, but more that it is important to know which groups that are vulnerable to this increase in prices and how can we reduce this vulnerability. And as you said, for example, it could be by increasing the productivity on the farm, but it could also be like connecting to other papers that help them to diversify their income. So, for example, increase the access to wage labor. So, yeah. And in Kenya, they are actually in some way controlling the prices a little bit already. So, yeah.
Yes, I will also just briefly respond to the very good comment there that. I want to emphasize that the free mechanisms that I was suggesting, they are by no means all kind of mechanisms. There are other things that also motivate people. And one important one when connecting to political decision-making is the social aspect. How is my helping decision, helping or not helping, or deciding which to help, influencing my reputation? And, of course, political decisions are, in general, public, or at least possibly public. So of course decision making that can also very much influence how much to help and whom to help, and I think that's an extremely important mechanism, but in dissertation I focus on the free, more internal one, which is non-social.
Finally, I would like to invite EBA to work even closer with FormSid, because we need more research to develop methodology. And I think we can also provide EBA and other research institutes with examples from our practical work and from our country offices and programs. So I look forward to work even closer to EBA in the future. Thank you.
I would just like to thank you for this opportunity, and in that respect, and what we're trying to do here, no, is to bring as greatly so to try to bring the research that we bring as to maybe reduce the necessity that you have to know it all. Do you need to have the 500 years of history? Well, I think that's our job to make it more reachable. That is that we can convey years of work that it takes to do that. And so, but then of course we need that time, you know, that's the difficult, you know, to have the time to do thorough work and then convey it in the most clear and usable way. So I think from that part it's on us also to be able to do it and if for taking these initiatives and trying to bridge sometimes those worlds that are not always so that are so related, and you make change and we study you and then we keep it to ourselves. What's the point, right? So thank you very much. So thank you.
Thank you. I think just in terms of what Eva said about how the donor could actually understand the local context and so on, I think this EBA is doing a very good job in this, in trying to relate the existing research and bringing in some of the results into the policy and decision makers. I think this is really, should be more encouraged to do more of this kind of work, because there's a lot of work out there already. In terms of the difference between the Cambodia and Vietnam that you highlighted, I think that's also an important issue, and I also talk about it in my book as well. And it's also look at some kind of historical difference between the civil society of Vietnam and Cambodia was also an important issue. I think the Cambodians NGOs, that so to say, ECOL NGOs, they really mushroomed as a result of very much donor coming in after signing of the peace agreement in 1991, and they really needed the NGO and to grow, the sector to grow. It was, I think, the NGO sector in Cambodia grew very much together with this development and donor coming into Cambodia. Whereas in Vietnam, it was a very different context, because for quite some time, this so-called civil society they had this mass organization in Vietnam, which was part of the Communist Party, which was considered as the civil society, such as Farmers Association, the Women's Association, and so on. And they played somewhat the role the civil society would play at the grassroots level. So when this so-called new type of NGO, which is not associated with this Communist Party, came in, I think this was a bit of, and it still is in the kind of transition phase for people to understand who is these new NGO groups, because particularly at the grassroots level, they don't really know the NGOs. So it's very difficult for those newly coming NGO in Vietnam to connect with the local level. So they would need to actually work with existing organizations. So this is a huge difference between the way they operate in Cambodia, where NGOs are directly connected to the communities and so on. So there's a quite some difference.
Thank you. Gun, do you want to?
Is there time or no time?
Well, there is actually no time. But if you want, just to make a brief final comment.
No, I'm thinking about the role of institutions and institutional change, which we touched upon. There's a lot to say about that. I'm not going into that. But the need to know more is definitely there within among donors, not least. I mean, research is ongoing. There's more to be done. Mm. But we have actually tried, and you and I worked together on that at SIDA for some 10 years ago, to start a learning process on how we work with institutional development in SIDA. That process has not been taken forward, but I looked at one of the documents that it may be worth going back to. But I would like to say a few things. An institutional perspective is useful for donors. It helps to sort of unfold the context and make the hidden explicit. So it could be used by donors, for instance, and other development actors for contextual analysis of different kinds, beyond the aim of supporting institutional change. But the institutional concept is tricky. Institutions are abstract, they're invisible, and there's a lot of conceptual confusion. And I think understanding institutions as rules of the game, behavioral rules for social interaction, has not landed at SIDA, despite a lot of work over the years. And the general applicability of the concept makes it theoretical. I mean, it can be used in any economic sector, or any sector, economic, political, social, cultural rules, and that makes it abstract too. So it's important to deal with it probably in specific and concrete settings and related to specific issues to make it understandable. But I think for donors it would be useful to have access to literature reviews, what we call synthesis studies of findings as regards institutional change, successful stories, role of donors in these processes. That would help further than individual studies.
Okay, thank you. I think that was a very nice last comment. So I just want to end this seminar by thanking all participants so much for your interest and for audience for being here. I hope you will come back to our next seminar. We'll have one next week presenting a study on how human rights are being considered in private sector or mining development, supported by development cooperation. So thank you very much today, and please join us, and if not, have a nice evening.